Welcome to Soch Bichar. We're going to take up the issue of civil service reform again, given the fact that the Imran government is taking an interest in it. But this time we'll come at it from a very different point of view. You've all met Khalid Malik before. He has talked to us on two occasions before. He's a China expert, a UN development expert, has worked in many countries on development issues, has been now has really, really specialized in China, written a book on China too. So welcome, Khalid Malik.
Great pleasure to be here, Nadeem.
Now, Khalid, as you told me, you saw that the Civil Service Reform Committee has been suggested and it's going to start working on the 14th. So I thought it's a good time to request you to give us an overview of civil service reform around the world, or you know, whatever has come across in your experience, and advise the committee on what to think about. So tell me, where would you begin to advise the committee?
Well, first of all, Nadeem, very pleased you are part of that.
Thank you.
And rely on you to raise questions and to go back to fundamentals. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about a few fundamentals. There's many people think of the Indian civil service, which the British set up, as the gold standard of civil service, because they managed with a small number of people to manage a very large territory. But the reality is that the focus of that civil service was on law and order fundamentally. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the 200 years the British ruled India, per capita income did not rise at all over 200 years.
Good
so
point.
That's a remarkable thing. So I think we have to be a bit careful to say we had a very honest, incorruptible civil service, which is true, because the Indian civil service was highly paid and very merit-driven. But the purpose of the civil service was different. So I think now we are coming to a situation where there are two strands of debates going on in Pakistan. One strand is we need to have merit-driven civil service. We need to be incorruptible. All that is fine because transparency is important, predictability is important, services have to be delivered. And the second part, which has not fully been thought through, is then this somehow magically transform itself into a developmental effort and developmental service. So I just want to raise this first general point.
Okay. So what you're saying is that basically we had a law and order civil service, and that civil service was meant for two purposes, control and extraction. Right?
Correct.
And now the demands with the SDGs and the MDGs and so many other things, the demands from the population are for public service delivery, for development, for many other things, not just law and order. Of course, central law and order still control still remains a primary purpose, but then development and public service delivery has also come in. Okay. Good point. Go ahead.
Yeah. So the second thing, let me then talk a little bit about China, because that's also been brought up in different ways. China actually does not have a unified civil service. And China, you could argue, has not been that evolved in a sophisticated civil service. But what they decided to do, you know, there is a phrase in China where that they said, our generation, the real war is that developmental war. So we, meaning civil servants, have to become soldiers in that war. So their focus fundamentally is progress. And what is fascinating for me was that at the provincial level, at the county level, if the officials did well, meaning that the county and the province was a high growth rate, so whatever the reference was, the officials were moved up. If they did not do well, they were moved away. It was quite a brutal system in some ways, because we are told in all the work done in results-based management is that we should make a distinction between outcomes and outputs, meaning that you not hold people accountable for what a county or a province is doing. You can only hold a person accountable for what he or she does. The Chinese took a different view on that. They said the real measure of progress is whether people's lives are improving or not, or whether the growth rate is moving up or not. If that does not work, you should not reward these people, even though they may be very bright, even though they may be working very hard. So that was the basic thrust. When I was in China in the UN, we tried to convince the Chinese government to start thinking of a different frame of accountability, meaning not just economic growth rates, but also the environment and social development. So we were involved in a 6-7 year very detailed effort on setting up a measurement system for civil servants, which made it a little broader than just growth rates. And, you know, there were times when provinces in China were clocking growth rates of 14, 16, 18% a year. But that was also gone a bit crazy because the incentives were strong. People were pushing. In the end, people respond to incentives. And therefore, as you know, being an economist, the theory of the second best, I do not mind if a civil service is not unitary or is not well designed. But I do mind if they do not deliver. So the incentive structure which has to be created has to be tilted in favor of developmental progress.
And good point, very good.
It doesn't matter to me too much if at the margin they are not fully incorruptible. People have been talking about the Singapore model or the Hong Kong model. When I was in China, I was also overseeing Hong Kong. And it was impressive for me that this, as a permanent secretary of a ministry, was making $40,000, $50,000 a month, three times more than what I was making. But honestly, I could not decide whether they were doing any better or not, because Hong Kong was fundamentally a city-state designed for the rich people. Inequalities were very high. Growth rates were skewed in a way in favor of the rich. So that if you ask for the poor people or housing, all kind of issues were there. And that was very much because they had taken the British model of keeping things stable, predictable, as opposed to developmentally driven model.
But Khalid, tell me, in China now, you said there is no civil service, right?
There's no unified civil service.
So how does it work? Let's say take the local level, for example. Who hires the public bureaucrat or whatever, the public servant? Who hires the public servant? Who pays him, and how is he evaluated? And what are his terms of the contract that he has with the local government?
Well, right now, if you, for instance, there are 2-3 different strands there. It's all very much merit-driven. One has to accept that.
Sure point.
But if you're in the Ministry of Commerce, your entire career is likely to be in the Ministry of Commerce.
Okay.
With a certain amount of moving around, a little bit overseas, like commercial counselors, or occasionally in the province.
Okay.
But the Chinese are also very clear that they do not want to have any senior leaders who have not dealt with people and progress and issues at the local level. So no senior leader is pushed up unless they have done their bit as governor, vice governor in the province. Because they feel that's the way to get close to what actually works or not. So that's one part. The second part is there's a very sharp pyramid structure, meaning that to go from one step to the next step is a highly competitive process. It's not predictable, meaning that you do not automatically have the right to become an assistant minister or vice minister. So they have actually cut-off lines that if you have not reached a director general of a department by X age, that's it. So the thing narrows a lot. So by the time you're director general or vice minister, you really are, you have demonstrated your value. And the rest are kind of moved away. So it's a bit tough. And then the other interesting dynamic is that if some provinces are lagging, meaning that they're not doing as well, they will bring the best people from the best provinces to go for 3-year attachments and try to fix that problem.
No, but when you say they, who is they in this case? Is it like a public service commission or something?
People who set up, there's a two parts of the system. One is the administrative part, meaning the ministries. The other part is the party, the Communist Party.
Okay.
And then there's a ministry called the Central Organization Department, which actually handles training, promotions. And they actually are very much involved in people moving up mm-hmm. in the system as a whole. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. different ministries handle their issues mostly themselves. Mm-hmm. Do you see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So there's no unified system which mm-hmm. covers everyone in China. Mm-hmm. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs is a bit different, partly because...
If there are ministries, how do the ministries interface with the provinces and local government? You see, the problem, and let me state it slightly differently. In Pakistan, we have one civil service that runs right. through the entire system. So when you get into the civil service, you know that very well. When you get into the civil service, the first appointment you have is a magistrate, second appointment DC, then commissioner. Then
the DMG group,
Yeah, then you get into the secretary and the provincial secretary, and then you get the federal secretary. Now, you're right, there are other groups, but those other groups are always inferior to the DMG. The DMG is the superior group, right? In every area, there's the town planners in the civil service, for example, but they remain junior to the commissioner in the DC. They never rise above the DC, right? There are doctors, for example, but they remain junior to the health secretary. They never rise above the health secretary, right? So we have determined by this pecking order that the local government is always going to be junior to the provincial, and the provincial government is always going to be junior to the federal. And that all these, the key agents are beholden to the federal government. In fact, owned by the federal government. Their own loan to the local government or the provincial government. Is that a good system? Is that the way China does it?
No, I mean, China is, maybe the answer isn't the question. The way you raise the question is totally different. Mm-hmm. I'm not even saying that necessarily it's the best system. Mm-hmm. But what I'm saying is that they have gotten the big things right.
Sure.
The big things being incentives.
Yeah.
The big things being that, for instance, at the provincial level, the people who are, there's a high decentralization of power in China. Mm-hmm. Governors, vice governors, party secretaries basically run a province. Mm-hmm. A province can be 80, 90, 100 million people. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then you have various ministries, people in different levels, you know, Minister of Commerce will have their office and so on, and other ministries as well. They will do their ministerial thing, but the people to bring things together are the governors or the vice governors.
Okay.
And that is very much a process driven by the Communist Party, not a civil service tradition. So unlike the deputy commissioner or a commissioner, if that's the DMG part, it's really the party who's driving that. And it's a bit tricky for a Ministry of Commerce person to suddenly move out and become a governor. It's possible, but it's a bit tricky. But so you think of it as tribes. There's a commerce tribe, there's a foreign affairs tribe. And somehow they're all brought together. But the incentive structure is such that you better perform at the county level or at the provincial level. Macro indicators. You're not performing how well you're doing your own job.
Right.
You're performing how well the county is doing. And according to that, there's an intricate set of standards which apply to it. Then the second part is constant training. There's a huge amount of... I heard somewhere that the Pakistan Army is very much into constant training, upgrading of skills, which the civil service is not. In China, the service as large is heavily invested into upgrading skills. They are both for ideological reasons, but also for technical reasons. You're constantly being upgraded. And then no policy is rolled out in one go. Deng Xiaoping was very profound when he said, you cross the stream by feeling the stones, meaning that don't jump. Try out piloting and experimentation. Learn from it. And once you learn from it, then you scale it up. And that, I think, has made what it meant was, even with all the imperfection of the structure, that you avoided big mistakes.
But Khaled, the problem there is, I see what you're saying, and I think it's very good, very interesting, but this is something... you can see it when it's done well, but I don't know whether it's copyable or not. Is that something we can, what are the key principles we can learn from here that you can take to Pakistan?
Well, I mean, copyable is very straightforward. Set the system of incentives. First of all, make it merit oriented, but I think this idea of a superior service is not a good idea at any level. At the tehsil level or the district level, you need to find the best people to do a job. The best people, how do you determine the best people, right? They have to be in relation to some objectives or some results which you have to define. What is the result for Faisalabad? We want to increase health posts. We want not just the delivery. You set up, you know, when you enter China, even at the immigration level, there are these little doodads. We say, were you satisfied with the service or not? You know, the person who's taking your passport and putting a stamp on it. And you press the right button, not very dissatisfied. Those scores are then used to assess performance. So the minute you, for instance, on service delivery, or even to say you start a road project, PWD, you say, okay, this is the X budget, and this is what we have to do in 2 years, and these are the milestones, put it up on the website, put it up on the social media, and then the social media institutions, people, civic society, others, will keep track of how well you're doing. And if you're not doing well, take the hard decisions. But you cannot allow our superior services ethos to protect each other.
Okay.
So, I mean, I'm talking about a set of incentives. Of course, you have to think about it. So to me, that's why...
But what incentive? The only incentive we can get... Look, we've got an incentive structure. We've got very good incentives. We don't have bad incentives. Think about it. When you're a junior civil servant, right? You don't get paid that well. But you have a lot of power.
Correct.
The moment you become a DC, you have a lovely house, in fact, 4 or 5 acre estate. You are the king of a huge city like Faisalabad. You could be the king of a city the size of 7 million or something. And you, if you're clever, you will start a development scheme there. You'll get a plot out of that. Meanwhile, you've got 2 huge Land Cruisers and you've got Outriders, etc. When you become a provincial secretary, you get a house in the city, a very nice house, beautiful house, and you get 5-6 cars and you get lots of servants and you get utility bills paid. When you become a federal secretary, I mean, the cash is always small. The federal secretary, for example, you get paid something like 1.5 to 2 lakh rupees, which is not a lot, but you have a lovely house, you have huge number of cars, you got servants, you got all kinds of, you're members of boards where you can get some more money, you can travel the world because all the donors are giving you funds to travel the world. So the incentives are there, very strong. What can we do?
No, I think I actually agree with you that, first of all, we should monetize these incentives. I mean, not incentives. These are not incentives. We monetize the conditions of service. Because that's a condition of service. There's no performance attached to it. Whether you good work or bad work, you still get those facilities.
Right.
So the minute you move them out into a standard amount of money, which I frankly, for me, it doesn't even have to be the same amount which the private sector does. I think there are enough people in Pakistan, given the size of the population, there you can give them a good salary and they will come for it. Public service is an inherent good in itself. So that's one part. But the bigger part is, now if you are a district commissioner or commissioner in Faisalabad, and things don't improve in Faisalabad, there should be disincentives for you as well. And that's what I meant by. And the incentives are very simple. Growth rate, social development, environmental stuff. Social service delivery, very straightforward. We can easily adapt the system we set up for the Chinese. And then very transparent. Everyone can see whether you're doing a meeting or not. And if you don't meet it over X period, you basically say, okay, this guy is not going to be a fast tracker anymore. And then you send him to some other place where he has to prove himself again. And if he doesn't do well again, terminate him. I mean, it's a bit tough and maybe a bit rough on the individual. But
the only problem that I have there is that we have to have a credible mechanism for measuring these outcomes.
But that's I mean, the credible measure is exactly. I think we should not. The USAID has spent decades of trying to talk about outputs and outcomes. You know, I led the resource-based management effort in the UN. So I was intimately involved in this thing. And I lost the battle with the UN because they were very reluctant to hold reps accountable for how well the country was doing.
Right.
So I was trying to make the argument that, look, if you look at the World Bank, if you look at the UN, all our projects are doing better. But the country may not be doing better, or the sector may not be doing better. So what is it important for you? What is important for Pakistan and Pakistanis is whether Pakistanis are doing better, right? So in Faisalabad, you have to have very simple 6, 7, 8 metrics, not more than that. Which says, okay, growth rates, social development issues, service delivery, environment status, in this way, which is even collected independently. So when it comes to the review exercise, so these guys will then start hustling because they will like to keep their jobs. And they will not no longer be interested in boards because they're fighting for their jobs, actually. And, I mean, I think this whole, this all British civil service mentality has to be moved out once for all. And by that, you just close up their houses. You close up all the servants and people who look after them and all the... There's almost a mini state looking after these little rajas, you know. We have to bring civil servants to become public servants.
Right.
Paid for by the people whose taxes you extract. So, and they have to also perform. If the performance is not there, then what good is it? Then you're going back to the model of the law and order. Or maybe not even that, just as a... You're almost like a sinecure, you know, like almost a medieval approach that we rely on you because you deliver certain things which we consider essential, which is...
Okay, fair enough. So one, you're saying results-based management, but results should be broader than just simple law and order. They should be more developmental and more modern results. Fair enough. And then you give them independence. And you, but also to have not one central superior service, to have many different services, professional services that are operating in different areas, and not necessarily in a very rigid framework, but capable of moving on. That's where we in Pakistan come a cropper, because the problem is that we can't seem to do anything without nepotism and sifarish and all that. So if we give anybody independent, we are very scared of trusting people. Obviously, in that environment, we can't trust people. So we can't turn around and say, okay, hey, let's make Khalid Malik responsible for, you know, looking after, let's say, the Economist service, right? Pretty soon we'll discover that nepotism and various, I'm not talking about you, but in Pakistan, nepotism and these things take over very quickly. How do we guard ourselves against this? And how can we have merit in place?
Yeah, I think actually the minute you introduce transparent results, you'll be surprised how quickly nepotism goes down. It will not disappear, of course, because there's a human tendency to
fair
do
point.
Certain things.
Fair point.
But it will go down because you know, these...
Let's face it, even Trump has done that. So what can you say?
Yeah, data is independently collected, right? People who are then debating these things may sit down in an office. They may know each other. But in the end, they have to justify why are they keeping the people who have not performed. And then if Faisalabad, you realize that the DC or the commissioner was... or those set of officials were not performing, you then bring in people who have done really well in Okara or somewhere.
Okay.
They say, your job. You see, because you have to see this as a lifelong struggle to succeed and make progress.
Fair point.
So over the years, you will see that people who do really well, do well regardless of the context.
Okay. Theek. Okay. Okay.
Because they're just very superior people.
Okay.
Superior service, I think you have to go to superior people.
Okay,
know?
Let's go beyond China now. Okay, so what are the principles that you learned from other countries?
Well, you know, this struggle between a civil service which is intact. East Africa, West Africa, you have very different systems in play. But many countries have not settled this thing well. Because they have inherited colonial systems. And in the end, we have been brainwashed to think of these things as superior somehow. And therefore, even in take the case of Kenya, Kenya is going through a rapid changes right now. But the system they have as a civil service is still devoted, like Pakistan, because it was in a British civil service, is still devoted to law and order. The same problems are there. So the countries which have done well, take the Singapore model. Singapore decided to go in a certain direction. But the guiding vision, because it's a relatively small country, was done by taking hard decisions, housing, developmental companies. They were done by people who were willing to break the mold, not the civil servants, by the way. So at some point, someone has to take the difficult decisions. But in a country as large as Pakistan, you cannot easily apply the Singapore model. Singapore is about 3 million, 3.5 million people, 4 maybe. the same is true of Hong Kong. Hong Kong is about 7 million people. But you can see the minute you take the lid off, there are a lot of issues in terms of development. So regardless of the way you design a civil service, the thrust has to be developmental. You take the case of law and order. In the UK, they did some interesting experiments on it. And in the police officers and or police services would normally post a number of crimes, or how many people were. They decided to make it much more outcome-driven at the district level or at the local tehsil level. And you'll saw very quickly that some tehsils were doing better than others. So then they were forced to come to grips with why is that the case. Before, they were not disaggregating data. So the way to actually get a handle over even crime is that. Amartya Sen made a fascinating presentation. He and I did something together actually in Hong Kong some years ago where he showed it's not that crime in Calcutta, for instance, is among the lowest in the world as a city, even better than Tokyo. And the question is why? Because people think of crime being a function of education, for instance. And it turns out the answer is very fascinating, that it is is basically the prevalence of public goods. So rich people, poor people went on the same railway system to go for jobs in the morning and the evening. There were very few communities which were gated communities. So you may have rich houses, but also have poor houses. So the sense of community was strong. There was a strong investment in education, particularly in public education. And this was one of the reasons at the low level of income, you had a very low incidence of crime. So crime, the minute you start looking at that way, the minute you put up data up on the website and say, okay, in Okara, the murder rate was this, but in Lahore, it's like that, people forced to then ask difficult questions of the police. And it's not just a question of having more people under Wardi, you know. It's a question of doing other things as well.
Sure. Okay. That sounds very interesting. I think I've got two or three very interesting pointers there. One is to go for results-based management. Two is to have, better or more fine-tuned data collection on outcomes, which we still don't have.
But to define the outcomes at the macro level, not at the micro level.
But macro level at the district level, because right now we don't have any.
Outcomes. At the district level, but there are more broader outcomes.
Make the whole focus much more localized development and think about that. And then also to think about professionalization or professional silos that are able to contribute in a general fashion. So it's kind of what the bank tried to do at one point, which is to have professions and then mapped into sectors. So you have this professionals were hired by the sectors to do the work. So something like that would sound really interesting. But one thing that I would say in the end, it seems that there would be a lot of emphasis then on research and thought. Because right now, what I found, I find one thing that is totally missing in our government, there's absolutely zero respect for research in our government. And in Pakistan, in fact, I think the government does not even spend 0.1% of its budget on research. How would you react to that? Should civil servants be doing more research or not?
Well, I think if you make a general principle that no decision can be taken without evidence, based whatever research analysis you call it, you cannot take a decision without evidence saying has it worked elsewhere or not. That's what I meant by Deng Xiaoping's crossing the stream by feeling the stones. The minute you do that, you're creating a demand for research results, independently verified researchers.
So you have got a problem here. We've got a problem here, Khaled. Our civil servants always say in every meeting, sir, we don't need to reinvent the wheel. This is not rocket science. We know what needs to be done. So we can't wait for research because we're always in a hurry. We have to develop fast. So we must quickly start acting without thought. That's one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is that we've got so many consultants. There are about 70 donor agencies sitting in Islamabad. Each one of them has a huge report in his pocket. So these guys say, oh, we got all the research that we need. So we'll just take their research and we'll start working. Do you think that works?
Well, my views on that. First of all, I think like anything, for any decision, any policy to succeed, it has to be profoundly sprung from internal reviews, internal sources. You cannot have outsiders telling you what to do. You can, of course, consult with them. They can inform you. But you have to do your own homework first. Otherwise, what are you? You cannot differentiate. Is the East African model the best, or the World Bank model is the best, or the different model is even better? You need to do your own thinking. You can certainly consult anyone you want.
In other words, learn globally but apply locally.
No, and learn locally as well. What works in one area may not work in other areas.
Absolutely.
It's difficult to judge these things unless you're invested in that. Second, you have to find a way to overcome this notion of I know best. And I can tell you, again, I'm sorry to go back to China. We started a leadership training program where vice ministers and above we sent overseas to learn about how other countries had dealt with environment and social development. In the end, over 4 years, we sent 400 ministers overseas. Can you believe that? And I participated in some of these groups myself. And what impressed me most was that every day, at the end of the day, there was a discussion among the group. They will do a summary of what they have learned, and they will send that summary to Beijing. So when you talk to Pakistan and Pakistani ministers or leaders, they say, but we know everything. We don't need to be trained. So I would like to submit that everyone, including us, can learn more, understand more, become better. So training, the notion of training has to be built in, especially for leaders.
But let me ask you a question. Again, training. We've got a lot of training. Khaled, my city, Lahore, and I think you also come from Lahore. Lahore, the prime real estate in Lahore is all training. We've got the staff college, we've got the civil service academy, we've got the NEPA, we've got all of the Mall Road covered with training. We've got about, I think, if I'm not mistaken, maybe about 200-300 acres of prime property in Lahore, which could be worth billions of dollars, you know, allocated to research. So where are we going wrong?
Is it research or is it...
Sorry, training.
Yeah. I can't easily comment on the level of training and the content of training. Mm. The point is that at each level, you need the more skills development. Huh?
Okay. And what kind of skills would you say would be developed?
And I would say that the higher up you go, the more awareness and more building up of your thinking has to take place. Mm. So you cannot assume that just because you've gone to good universities or you've become a secretary of a government, that suddenly you know everything.
Right.
And that's the problem in a way, because that's the contrast. Mm. You have to instill this idea there's a constant learning phenomena going on. How you organize it, that's a decision you have to then take based on your own realities. Huh? Mm. But the idea that because you know everything, sir, we know everything and we'll just do it, that's move things up. I mean, I take the case of crime. Mm. Crime will not be affected if you do not do certain things in a broader perspective. But then you need the data behind it.
Right.
You need to understand the reason behind it. And if the argument is that there's not enough public goods, it's not enough for the police force to deal with it. It has to be done as a whole of government concept.
But then, what you're saying also means that we need people out there who are ready to think and learn. For example, I found in the government in Pakistan, there was such a hurry. And the whole day was spent in meetings because we were always in a hurry. And I used to ask them all the time, when do you have the time to read? And people said, reading is a luxury. I don't have the time to read.
Yeah, I shouldn't say. Recently, I had to go to a consulate. We had some property issues we were trying to sort out. And the consul general was fascinating for me because we are sitting with the consul general. Mm. The person is getting calls continuously. The chaiwala is coming with the tea continuously. And it is almost like a theater.
Yeah.
No conversation is being, no single conversation is being fully realized. But the bits and pieces. So the man is supremely busy. But that's not of value, frankly, either to the state or to the performance of the job. So I think we have to, I mean, you can't change all of these things in one fell swoop.
But you see, the other thing that worries me is, for example, this is going a little further afield than we should, but in any case, let's do it. You know, this business that they've started off, and this has been done before, I don't blame this government, it's been done by every government, that we'll put in an economic advisory council. I don't see the, or even other, like the task forces or whatever. They've got about 30 of these councils going on right now. Do you see any value in that?
Well, let's take a step back. Step back was that the Prime Minister said in one of his first speeches that we will focus on human development. And then we would like to learn from China. He raised these two very interesting points. So if you look at the composition of the Economic Council, there are very few of them who have much exposure background in human development.
And so, none of them have exposure to China.
And none of them have exposure to China. So, you know, already you say, all right, here's a kind of a vision statement. And how is it connected to people who may know something about it so that they can do something with it? So that's a general point. The second is, in the end, you have to take difficult decisions. And councils and committees don't do that for you. And I was profoundly embarrassed when I read at least the newspapers that after the first meeting of the Economic Advisory Council, a big decision was taken to kind of stop cheese imports.
Cheese imports, yeah. Cheese. Who moved my cheese?
This is getting profoundly sad. So, I mean, if you want to deal with trade, then basically get yourself educated where is Pakistan on the trading setup. Then you see, okay, what, you know, there are difficult questions. I mean, if you remember in Malaysia, the way they dealt with the not devaluating exchange, it was to close the capital account. So if you, I mean, these are things, I'm not suggesting you should go one direction or the other. But at least to have a conversation on that.
These are all ideas that are worth thinking about and developing.
Exactly.
But let me take you.
Could you depreciate the currency just willy-nilly? Will that affect exporters doing better? Not really.
But another point, Khalid, that comes to mind, since I used to work in the IMF, you worked in the UNDP. I think very similar structures. We, after all, we were a part of a international governance. We were bureaucrats in this government, right? Okay. Now, in our bureaucracies, what I found, which is fascinating, which I keep telling people in Pakistan, but nobody bothers, that for a start, every person, every year, I had to show how many research papers or reports I'd done. There was actually written work that I had to show every month, every year, right? And that written work would be research, either a research paper that is publishable or whatever, or a research or report on a country. So that I had to go to country, I had to look up, you know, do all kinds of things in a country, prepare a proper... I mean, everybody's seen these IMF reports, so I don't have to talk about it. Everybody's seen the UNDP reports. We had to prepare those things every year. And most of our work, especially the country work, the policy work, would go to the board. And in your case, it'll go to your board, right? And the board, we never gave half-chewed ideas. There were proper reports that were thoroughly prepared and thoroughly reviewed. They were reviewed about 5 or 6 times by very senior committees, etc. And only a final, well-developed product that was readily publishable would go to the board. Right. So each one of us, the third element, which is also very important, in each department in the fund, and I'm sure it's the same in the UN, we were required to have a seminar every week. There was a seminar in every department every week. And you were also required to present, and you were also required to be at those seminars to listen to people. So that is a part of continuous training on your...
Correct.
Apart from other internal training mechanisms. So we had a menu of training options. In fact, there were so many that at times, you know, I felt that, you know, I just didn't have the time to follow them. I wanted to go to this or that. I could go to all of them, but I could not find the time to do it, right? So... In Pakistan, for example, there's not a single seminar anywhere. I tried to hold seminars when I was in the Planning Commission, the PID. The bureaucrats always said that, no, either we are too superior to attend. I can only come and chair the session. I can't attend. Or alternatively, there's nothing you guys can teach me. Right. The second important point is that reports have gone out of the system now. Nobody writes a report anymore. There used to be a time, even in the British days, when they wrote the District Gazetteer. District gazetteers are gone, policy papers are gone, sector reports are gone. So they actually don't write any reports anymore. Does that happen in China and other places?
Well, China, as you know, has a huge network of research institutions connected to every ministry and the government at large. Mm-hmm. The Socialist Sciences Academy is massive in terms of numbers of people. Mm-hmm. And every ministry has a number of institutes, not just one, connected to it. Mm-hmm. And it's, as I said, the minute you say that no policy can be enacted without looking at available evidence, both global and local, then you'll create a demand for that again. Mm-hmm. They don't take policies, decisions without doing all of that work. So there's a huge amount of churning of research results and discussions of results and things like the debates. And there's the debates within the government, the debates within the party itself. And then there's an attempt to bring it together. And people have many strong views. I still remember we were doing this human development report in China. And you had central level officials, very senior, meeting with district level officials, again, quite senior. But what was fascinating, I was the only non-Chinese there. And they said, the central guys are saying something, and the district level saying, you can say whatever you want, but we will decide what we really need, because we know exactly what the situation is. Very bluntly, to a minister. So you have to create a sense of enough confidence in these people to argue for their point of view.
Okay, great.
And that there's one point we should quickly cover, and that's independence, protection. How do you protect, you know, when you give a person a job, you have to somehow also protect them to do the job, right? And how do you, in the case of Pakistan, you have to protect them from the elected officials. Already you're getting situations in Lahore and others where these guys want to have their people on boards and on this, recruitment. If you allow the political system to infect the bureaucratic system, you will never get out of it. The problem is that these are the perks of the political system. Meaning that when you become a MNA or MPA, then you feel entitled to, you know, give largesse.
Absolutely, absolutely.
This so you have to find a way. Yeah. You have to find a way to say, look, we can certainly bring in the MPA, MNA in the decision-making process in terms of defining a need. But we, the bureaucracy, must be given the autonomy to define how it is going to be done. I mean, you, because political masters are important, you must tell us the need factor, the priority factor. But we will decide on how we deliver on it. Then you hold us accountable on the results.
Sure. Okay.
You can't have it both ways.
Okay. Well, let me see. I'm going back to Pakistan soon. Let me see if I can carry these ideas and push them out there. And if necessary, I'll get you on Skype, because now they say that meetings can be held on Skype.
In fact, you know what? Just leave a thought for you.
Yeah.
So when you are there and these things are being, by all means, you can do a impromptu lock visa for the whole group.
Of course.
And this is a way to, and not educate them, but it's a way to kind of
encourage them. Ultimately, it's cross-fertilization. That's what we need. And unfortunately, we become too insular in Pakistan. We need to cross-fertilize far more than we do. So thank you. Thank you very much, Khalid. As always, you're very informative.
Great pleasure.